So welcome back. This evening we continue in Chapter 6, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. Sri Aurobindo is at pains here to look deeply into the Advaita Vedanta's perspective on how it accounts or discounts for the presence of a universe as opposed to the reality of a single all-conscious being incapable of division, incapable of diminution of consciousness. So we've seen in the last bit that he's presented an argument so far, which is to regard the subjective illusion consciousness in an effort to avoid an absolute unreality applied to the universe. Trying to find a way out of saying the universe is an utter illusion. So that first argument we're drawing to a close in the next couple of paragraphs. He continues, "It may be noted, however, that nowhere in the Upanishads is it actually laid down that the threefold status is a condition of illusion or the creation of an unreality." He's speaking here of the states of waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And this is a specific reference back to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad that he cited at the beginning of the last chapter, and also the Mandukya Upanishad. "It is constantly affirmed that all this that is, this universe we are now supposing to have been constructed by Maya, is the Brahman, the reality. The Brahman becomes all these beings. All beings must be seen in the self, the reality, and the reality must be seen in them. The reality must be seen as being actually all these beings, for not only the self is Brahman, but all is the self. All this that is the Brahman, the reality." And of course, this is the standpoint of the original Vedanta, the end of the Veda, encapsulated in the Upanishads, which is furthered and confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Advaita Vedanta, let's say, begins roughly around 800 CE, so comes 1,000 or 2,000 years after the formulation of the original Vedanta. And in reaction to the historical force which was Buddhism. He continues, "That emphatic asseveration leaves no room for an illusory Maya. But still, the insistent denial that there is anything other than or separate from the experiencing self, certain phrases used, and the description of two of the states of consciousness as sleep and dream may be taken as if they annulled the emphasis on the universal reality. These passages open the gates to the illusionist idea and have been made the foundation for an uncompromising system of that nature." So in other words, there are some passages in the Upanishads, if you twist the meaning or pull them out of their rightful context, can seem to deny the reality of the universe or to say that it may be as fitful as a dream or vanishes just as when we are in deep sleep. He continues, if we take this fourfold status as a figure of the self passing from its superconscient state, where there is no subject or object, into a luminous trance in which superconscience becomes a massed consciousness out of which the subjective status of being and the objective come into emergence, then we get, according to our view of things, either a possible process of illusionary creation or a process of creative self-knowledge and all knowledge. So the fourfold status, as described in the Mandukya, that fourth status is beyond all measuring, beyond simply the deep consciousness of the self-absorbed in its own being, which is analogized to the state of deep sleep, nor is it the creative consciousness of the dream sleep, nor is it the extension of that dream consciousness into the waking consciousness, but that fourth state is something really which is inclusive of all. Waking, dreaming, sleeping, all are comprised in the being of that fourth. What he calls here that superconscience. So the superconscience can install itself as a massed consciousness, and this is an interesting phrase. This in Sanskrit is chidgana, which is a term used by Madhvacharya, who is not an Advaita Vedantin, but actually a theistic Vedantist. And then comes out of that massed consciousness the subjective dream state, which conceives of the universe, and that conception is then installed in the materiality of what is our normal experience and our waking self. So there again we have the four states, fourfold status of a single self. Now to continue, in fact, if we can judge from the description of the three lower states of self as the all-wise intelligence, there's a footnote here. Let's stop and read through the footnote. We'll come back and re-begin the paragraph. Prajna, Yajñavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, states very positively that there are two planes or states of the being which are two worlds, and that in the dream state one can see both worlds, for the dream state is intermediate between them. It is their joining plane. This again is the Brihadaranyaka 4, 3, verses 9 through 12, which was cited in our earlier chapter. Let's read those again from that. Quote, there are two planes, sthana, of this conscious being, this and the other worlds. A third state is their place of joining, the state of dream. And when he stands in this place of their joining, he sees both planes of his existence, this world and the other world. When he sleeps, he takes the substance, the matra, of this world in which all is, and himself undoes, and himself builds by his own illumination, his own light. When this conscious being sleeps, he becomes luminous with his self-light, Swayam Jyoti. So Sri Aurobindo continues in the footnote, this makes it clear that he, Yajñavalkya, is speaking of a subliminal condition of the consciousness which can carry in it communications between the physical and the supraphysical worlds, the worlds above the physical. The description of the dreamless sleep state applies both to deep sleep and to the condition of trance in which one enters into a massed consciousness containing in it all the powers of being, but all compressed within itself and concentrated solely on itself. And when active, then active in a consciousness where all is the self. This is clearly a state admitting us into the higher planes of the spirit, normally now superconscient to our waking being. So Yajñavalkya in the Upanishad was referring to a consciousness which is continuous as it transits from one state to the other, and that from that bridging consciousness one can see above, one can see below. And therefore he's describing a conscious integration of all these worlds in the awareness of the seer, or at least its possibility. So now we can come back and start the paragraph again. In fact, if we can judge from the description of the three lower states of self as the all-wise intelligence, the seer of the subtle, and the seer of the gross material existence, this sleep state and this dream state seem to be figurative names for the superconscient and the subliminal, which are behind and beyond our waking status. They are so named and figured because it is through dream and sleep, or trance, which can be regarded as a kind of dream or sleep, that the surface mental consciousness normally passes out of the perception of objective things into the inner subliminal and the superior supramental or overmental status. So this is the means of the yogic ascent of consciousness. In that inner condition, it sees the supraphysical realities in transcribing figures of dream or vision, or in the superior status, it loses itself in a masked consciousness of which it can receive no thought or image. So again, in the climbing up, when we view things from that superior plane of consciousness, we transcribe them into images and figurings which are pertinent to our normal experience of the world. When we climb to a still higher level, what he's calling here superconscient, then even that goes. Having referred to the superior, supramental, or overmental status in the previous sentence, again, he must be referring to it here. And now back to his argument. If we make the transition, not through dream trance or sleep trance, but through a spiritual awakening into these higher states, we become aware in all of them of the one omnipresent reality. The title of Book One of the Life Divine. There need be no perception of an illusionary Maya. There is only an experience of the passage from mind to what is beyond it, so that our mental structure of the universe ceases to be valid, and another reality of it is substituted for the ignorant mental knowledge. In this transition, it is possible to be awake to all the states of being together in a harmonized and unified experience, and to see the reality everywhere. So this is a connective, integrative, greater experience. But if we plunge by a trance of exclusive concentration into a mystic sleep state, or pass abruptly in waking mind into a state belonging to the superconscient, then the mind can be seized in the passage by a sense of the unreality of the cosmic force and its creations. It passes by a subjective abolition of them into the supreme superconscience. So in the one case, we have an integrative or connective experience which includes all in its experience of the Brahman and its reality, which is omnipresent. Or, if we use this root of trance, we can exclude through the experience of that supreme state by going into either this mystic sleep state or jumping from mind into the superconscient. Then all else falls away, looking as if it is not real. We are only aware of this transition from one to the other. Having reached the other, the one we've just left looks unreal, puny, dismissible. He writes, this sense of unreality and this sublimating passage are the spiritual justification for the idea of a world created by Maya. But this consequence is not conclusive, since a larger and more complete conclusion superseding it is possible to spiritual experience. He does not challenge the validity of the experience of this absoluteness of being, but it is not the comprehensive spiritual experience which is possible. All these and other solutions of the nature of Maya fail to satisfy because they have no conclusiveness. They do not establish the inevitability of the illusionist hypothesis, which, to be accepted, needs to be inevitable. They do not bridge the chasm between the presumed true nature of the eternal reality and the paradoxical and contrary character of the cosmic illusion. While using the term cosmic illusion is, of course, what the Advaitins use. That's not Sri Aurobindo's term. But he's saying, because it comports neither to logic nor to our inner experience, that it's not the only inevitable answer. There are other and better answers. We cannot accept their position. At the most, he says, a process is indicated that claims to make the coexistence of the two opposites conceivable and intelligible, but it has no such force of certitude or illuminating convincingness, effectively curing the improbability that its acceptance would be obligatory on the intelligence. The theory of the cosmic illusion gets rid of an original contradiction, a problem and mystery which may be otherwise soluble, by erecting another contradiction, a new problem and mystery which is irreconcilable in its terms and insoluble. For we start with the conception or experience of an absolute reality, which is in its nature eternally one, supracosmic, static, immobile, immutable, self-aware of its pure existence, and a phenomenon of cosmos, dynamism, motion, mutability, modifications of the original pure existence, differentiation, infinite multiplicity. So we're back to the experience of pure Brahman and then the multifarious nature of the universe. This phenomenon is got rid of by declaring it to be a perpetual illusion, Maya. But this brings in effect, a self-contradictory dual status of consciousness of the one to annul a self-contradictory dual status of being of the one. Remember Satchit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, all part of one reality. And I do grant you that the idea of Satchit-Ananda does not appear in Shankara's work anywhere. It's a later idea. It comes a few centuries after him. A phenomenal truth of multiplicity of the one is annulled by setting up a conceptual falsehood in the one, creating an unreal multiplicity. The one, forever self-aware of its pure existence, entertains a perpetual imagination or illusory construction of itself as an infinite multiplicity of ignorant and suffering beings unaware of self, who have to wake one by one to awareness of self and cease individually to be. So Sri Aurobindo has written an elaborate joke here, because how could a Brahman who is all consciousness and all being so delude himself and divide himself as to become all of that? And then to free himself one little molecule at a time out of his infinite expanse of being. In face of this solution of a perplexity by a new perplexity, we begin to suspect that our original premise must have been somewhere incomplete. Not an error, but only a first statement and indispensable foundation. We begin to envisage the reality as an eternal oneness, status, immutable essence of pure existence, supporting an eternal dynamis, motion, infinite multiplicity, and diversity of itself. The immutable status of oneness brings out of itself the dynamis, motion, and multiplicity. The dynamis, motion, and multiplicity not abrogating, but bringing into relief the eternal and infinite oneness. If the consciousness of Brahman can be dual in status or action, or even manifold, there seems to be no reason why Brahman should be incapable of a dual status or a manifold real self-experience of its being. The cosmic consciousness would then be not a creative illusion, but an experience of some truth of the Absolute. This explanation, if worked out, might prove to be more comprehensive and spiritually fecund, more harmonic in its juncture of the two terms of our self-experience, and it would be at least as logically tenable as the idea of an eternal reality supporting in perpetuity an eternal illusion, real only to an infinite multiplicity of ignorant and suffering beings who escape one by one from the obscurity and pain of Maya, each one by a separate extinction of itself in Maya. This is a summary statement of what is the Mayavadin's view of the universe and the beings in it, if they want to regain the state of self, these illusory beings. So he is dismissed with that. The first account that the Mayavadin might offer to afford some kind of reality to the universe, and that was the subjective, the idealist view. In a second possible answer on the illusionist basis to the problem, in the philosophy of Shankara, which may be described as a qualified illusionism, an answer which is presented with a force and comprehensiveness that are extraordinarily impressive, we make a first step towards this solution. The second answer is akin to Ramanuja and Vishishtadvaita, but it is also comparable to the position that Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan took in the 20th century, in some ways commenting on Sri Aurobindo's world-affirming philosophy. For this philosophy, he writes, affirms a qualified reality for Maya. It characterizes it indeed as an ineffable and unaccountable mystery, but at the same time it does present us with a rational solution, at first sight thoroughly satisfactory, of the opposition which afflicts our mind. It accounts for our sense of the persistent and pressing reality of the universe and our sense of the inconclusiveness, insufficiency, vanity, evanescence, a certain unreality of life, and phenomena. For we find a distinction made between two orders of reality, transcendental and pragmatic, absolute and phenomenal, eternal and temporal. The former, the reality of the pure being of Brahman, absolute and supracosmic and eternal. The latter, the reality of Brahman in Maya, cosmic, temporal, and relative. Here, we get a reality for ourselves and the universe, for the individual self is really Brahman. It is Brahman who, within the field of Maya, seems phenomenally to be subjected to her as the individual, and in the end, releases the relative and phenomenal individual into his eternal and true being. In the temporal field of relativities, our experience of the Brahman who has become all beings, the eternal who has become universal and individual, is also valid. It is indeed a middle step of the movement in Maya towards liberation from Maya. The universe, too, and its experiences are real for the consciousness in time, and that consciousness is real. But the question and extent of this reality at once arises. For the universe and ourselves may be a true reality, though of a lesser order, or they may be partly real, partly unreal, or they may be an unreal reality. If they are at all a true reality, there is no place for any theory of Maya. There is no illusory creation. If they are partly real, partly unreal, the fault must lie in something wrong either in the cosmic self-awareness or in our own seeing of ourselves and the universe, which produces an error of being, an error of knowledge, an error in the dynamis of existence. But that error can amount only to an ignorance or a mixed knowledge and ignorance. And what needs to be explained then is not an original cosmic illusion, but the intervention of ignorance in the creative consciousness or in the dynamic action of the eternal and infinite. So it's a different game. If you can't say that the universe is unreal but is the product only of ignorance, that is a completely different thing from saying it has no reality within it. So the Mayavadin is undone. Let's continue. But if universe and ourselves are an unreal reality, if to a transcendental consciousness all this has no truth of existence, and its apparent reality ceases once we step out of the field proper to Maya, then the concession accorded with one hand is taken away by the other. For what was conceded as a truth turns out to have been, all the time, an illusion. Maya and cosmos and ourselves are both real and unreal, but the reality is an unreal reality, real only to our ignorance, unreal to any true knowledge. So first, an argument that reality renders Maya void. The second, a wrong seeing based on ignorance. And third, an unreal reality, which essentially cancels out both terms. It is difficult to see why, once any reality is conceded to ourselves and to the universe, it should not be a true reality within its limits. It may be admitted that the manifestation must be on its surface a more restricted reality than the manifested. Our universe is, we may say, one of the rhythms of Brahman, and not, except in its essential being, the whole reality. But that is not a sufficient reason for it to be set aside as unreal. It is no doubt so felt by mind withdrawing from itself and its structures, but this is only because the mind is an instrument of ignorance, and when it withdraws from its constructions, from its ignorant and imperfect picture of the universe, it is impelled to regard them as nothing more than its own fictions and formations, unfounded, unreal. The gulf between its ignorance and the supreme truth and knowledge disables it from discovering the true connections of the transcendent reality and the cosmic reality. So cosmic reality is derived from the transcendent reality, but the ignorant mind cannot perceive the connection. That would be the instrumentation of a larger, more capacious knowledge of the supramental. In a higher status of consciousness, the difficulty disappears, the connection is established, the sense of unreality recedes, and the theory of illusion becomes superfluous and inapplicable. It cannot be the final truth that the Supreme Consciousness has no regard upon the universe, or that it regards it as a fiction which itself in time upholds as real. The cosmic can only exist by dependence on the supracosmic. Brahman in time must have some significance for Brahman in timeless eternity. Otherwise, there could be no self and spirit in things, and therefore no basis for the temporal existence. This is Sri Aurobindo's firm view. But the universe is condemned as ultimately unreal because it is temporary and not eternal, a perishable form of being imposed on the formless and imperishable. This is the Mayavada's perspective, and this is Advaita's response to the force of Buddhist logic. This relation can be illustrated by the analogy of earth and the pot made out of earth. The pot and other forms so created perish and go back to the reality earth. They are only evanescent forms. When they disappear, there is left the formless and essential earth and nothing else. But this analogy can tell more convincingly the other way. For the pot is real by right of its being made out of the substance of earth, which is real. It is not an illusion. And even when it is dissolved into the original earth, its past existence, cannot be thought to have been unreal or an illusion. The relation is not that of an original reality and a phenomenal unreality, but of an original, or if we go back from earth to the invisible substratum and constituent ether, an eternal and non-manifest, to a resultant and dependent, a temporal and manifested reality. Moreover, the pot form is an eternal possibility of earth substance or ethereal substance, and while the substance exists, the form can always be manifested. So there is that conceptive level of reality as well. That idea which forms the entity out of pure being. A form may disappear, but it only passes out of manifestation into non-manifestation. A world may disappear, but there is no proof that world existence is an evanescent phenomenon. On the contrary, we may suppose that the power of manifestation is inherent in Brahman and continues to act either continuously in time eternity or in an eternal recurrence. The idea of eternal recurrence, that time is cyclical, time observes cycles, is of course given strong interpretation and expression in the Bhagavad Gita, especially in the 8th chapter, but also figures in Shankara and Ramanuja in the field of Vedanta. And of course, the idea of eternal recurrence becomes a really big deal in Western philosophy when Nietzsche promulgates it, and then P.D. Uspensky and others take it up and carry it farther. For the purely intellectual conception, he continues, that only the eternal is real. Whoops, I've skipped a sentence. Pardon me. The cosmic is a different order of the real from the supracosmic transcendence, but there is no need to take it as in any way non-existent or unreal to that transcendence. For the purely intellectual conception that only the eternal is real, whether we take it in the sense that reality depends on perpetual duration or that the timeless only is true, is an ideative distinction, a mental construction. It is not binding on a substantial and integral experience. Time is not necessarily canceled out of existence by timeless eternity. Their relation is only verbally a relation of contradiction. In fact, it is more likely to be a relation of dependence, that is, time depends on eternity and expresses in some limited scope what the timeless is. Similarly, the reasoning which cancels the dynamics of the absolute, the imposition of the stigma of unreal reality on the pragmatic truth of things because it is pragmatic, is difficult to accept. For the pragmatic truth is, after all, not something quite other, quite separate and unconnected with spiritual truth. It is a result of the energy or emotion of the dynamic activity of the spirit. A distinction must no doubt be made between the two, but the idea of an entire opposition can rest only on the postulate that a silent and quiescent status is the eternal's true and whole being. But in that case, we must conclude that there is nothing dynamic in the absolute, and all dynamism is a contradiction of the supreme nature of the divine and eternal. So this is a logical demand, and you can see where this is leading. But if a temporal or cosmic reality of any kind exists, there must be a power, an inherent dynamic force of the absolute, which brought it into being. And there is no reason to suppose that the power of the absolute can do nothing but create illusions. On the contrary, the power that creates must be the force of an omnipotent and omniscient consciousness. The creations of the absolutely real should be real and not illusions, and since it is the one existence, they must be self-creations, forms of a manifestation of the eternal, not forms of nothing erected out of the original void. Whether a void being or a void consciousness by Maya. So the absolute must have inherently a creative power of consciousness which reaches into itself and manifests forms of itself in multiplicity, which are expressions in time of an eternal being. Clearly, if this is a Maya, it's not the Maya of the Mayavadins, of the Advaitins. It is not an illusory power or something that creates utter fictions. It must be a Maya that goes back to the original definition of it, Maya being that conscious force which measures out the infinite. So we have to bear in mind that this later development in Vedanta has a restricted interpretation of Maya outside the context of original Vedanta and its Vedic context. I think this is a good place to put a bookmark for this evening. So we'll continue with the argument next week and for several weeks more until we found our way out of the cosmic illusion. Let's read from Savitri again. Fittingly, this is from the Book of Yoga, Canto 6, Nirvana, and the All-Negating Absolute. This is the appearance in our mortal front. Our greater truth of being lies behind. Our consciousness is cosmic and immense, but only when we break through matter's wall, in that spiritual vastness can we stand, where we can live, the masters of our world, and mind is only a means and body a tool. For above the birth of body and of thought, our spirit's truth lives in the naked self, and from that height, unbound, surveys the world. Out of the mind she rose to escape its law, that it might sleep in some deep shadow of self, or fall silent in the silence of the unseen. High she attained and stood from nature free, and saw creation's life from far above. Thence upon all she laid her sovereign will to dedicate it to God's timeless calm. Then all grew tranquil in her being's space. Only sometimes small thoughts arose and fell, like quiet waves upon a silent sea, or ripples passing over a lonely pool when a stray stone disturbs its dreaming rest. Yet the mind's factory had ceased to work. There was no sound of the dynamo's throb. There came no call from the still fields of life. Then even those stirrings rose in her no more. Her mind now seemed like a vast empty room, or like a peaceful landscape without sound. This men call quietude and prize as peace. But to her deeper sight all yet was there, effervescing like a chaos under a lid. Feelings and thoughts cried out for word and act, but found no response in the silenced brain. All was suppressed, but nothing yet expunged. At every moment might explosion come. Then this too paused. The body seemed a stone. All now was a wide, mighty vacancy. but still excluded from eternity's hush. For still was far the repose of the absolute and the ocean silence of infinity. We shall continue this passage next week when we read from Savitri, after we read from The Life Divine. So, namaste. Jai Ma.